to date, every attempt to move the newspaper business into a money-making digital enterprise has either failed or fallen well short of expectations. Add on top of this, newspapers last year faced a crisis of legitimacy. The term fake news began to be applied to the legacy news outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post. We're talking about the future of print journalism, the forms it takes, how to keep it sustainable here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Dan Kennedy studies the flux from his job as associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. His new book is The Return of the Moguls, How Jeff Bezos and John Henry Are Remaking Newspapers for the 21st Century. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, set the stage for us here. We know that newspapers have been struggling. We've seen the waves of layoffs, the headlines there. But what are the factors in play that got to this point?
Well, that's a very good question. And I would trace it back to the hopes that everybody had maybe 20, 25 years ago when newspapers first started moving into the digital space. Originally, we thought that newspapers could, by getting rid of the printing and distribution costs they had, offer the news for free and move into a wonderful new world of multimedia advertising online. And, excuse me, it did not work out. And what happened was Craigslist came along and destroyed classified advertising, which had accounted for 40% of newspapers' revenues. And then a few years later, it became apparent that the rest of the ads that we typically encountered in a newspaper, the display ads, were not going to make a successful transition to online. I would contend that no one has ever clicked on a banner ad except by mistake. And then the final nail in the coffin, as it were, is that even as the value of these digital ads were dropping because they were so ubiquitous, Google and Facebook became the behemoths that they are today and took essentially all new spending on digital advertising. So what newspapers have been left with is the idea that if they are going to be able to survive in the digital age, they've got to be able to convince their readers to pay for news. And actually, the Return of the Moguls takes a look at how Jeff Bezos and John Henry at the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, respectively, as well as a few others, set about trying to do that.
But shouldn't powerful journalism drive eyeballs, so to speak? You know, bringing people in, drawing them in through the storytelling, through the breaking news, through all that journalism. Shouldn't that be able to at least square with a balance sheet?
Well, there is no issue with the size of the audience. That's not the issue. The issue is that we had hoped that with the large audiences that are coming to news sites online would come advertising revenues, and that simply didn't materialize. So, yes, we do have these eyeballs coming in. People at the Boston Globe like to say they probably have a larger audience than they've ever had in their history if you add the various digital platforms that they have to the print readers that they continue to have. The question is how to turn that audience into revenue, and that's really what the challenge is today.
Well, let's turn our attention to these 21st century newspaper moguls that you write about, these wealthy buyers scooping up newspapers. These are "quote unquote" rich men, not many women in this storyline, with the hope of turning things around. When did you see this really start taking off as an idea?
You know, you make a very good point, because if you look back at the history of newspaper ownership, probably the most important mogul of the past, who was a woman, was Katharine Graham of the Washington Post, and it's very hard to point to many others. The modern moguls, people like Jeff Bezos and John Henry, are different from the newspaper moguls of the past in that they made their money elsewhere, and the hope is that they will be able to apply the knowledge that they gained in other businesses to the struggling newspaper business. And really, the idea for this came together in August of 2013 in one weekend. On a Friday, we learned that John Henry, who is a billionaire financier who is also the principal owner of the Red Sox, was going to buy the Boston Globe. The following Monday, Jeff Bezos of Amazon announced that he would buy the Washington Post. And since we always need three to make a trend...
thanks for pointing that out.
at the same time, Aaron Kushner, who was himself a wealthy entrepreneur, who had tried to buy the Boston Globe, by the way, was getting some very good reviews for what he was doing at the Orange County Register in Southern California. He was putting a lot of investment into the print edition. So at that point, I thought that it would be worth following these three people. It did not work out with Kushner, and he's gone from the scene, although he's still in the book. What all three of them were trying to do in different ways was to find ways to persuade readers to pay for the news again as they had in the past.
Well, I don't know if a trifecta can turn around in this industry, but let's look at Jeff Bezos here for a moment, where you attempted to be able to have that one-on-one interview with him that didn't pan out. But what we have known from what he's said in his press events, and you know that he's giving the Washington Post a runway, so to speak, but it's not an endless runway, that he does want to staff up, but making some real careful business moves. So what can Jeff Bezos do for the Washington Post that other, you know, eccentric owners and the Graham family couldn't do?
Right. Well, that's a good point. And by the way, I want to point out that although Jeff Bezos would not talk to me, and he tends not to talk to anybody, including the Washington Post, I got very good access to everyone else I wanted to speak to, including John and Linda Henry at the Globe and Aaron Kushner, formerly of the Orange County Register. Jeff Bezos came into the Post with a unique set of circumstances that gave him a chance to succeed that really went beyond what the owners of large regional newspapers can do. The first and most important thing that Bezos did was he said, I want to kind of get out of the regional newspaper business. It's the worst part of the news business. It's an almost impossible challenge. And we'll get to that when we talk about some of the others. Instead, we're based in Washington. What happens here is of interest to the country. We're now a national digital news organization. And the Post went about attracting an enormous online audience, competitive with the New York Times, 80 to 100 million unique visitors a month. And the goal has been to try to persuade some small percentage of those visitors to become paying subscribers. And they've had quite a bit of success with that. The Post now says it has more than a million paid digital subscribers, which is a very good record. It's not as good as the New York Times, but it's better than any of the other regionals. The second thing that he did that, again, is not really available to other newspaper owners is he's leveraged the Post with Amazon in some pretty interesting ways. There's a Washington Post app that is pre-installed on the Kindle Fire. It comes at a huge discount with Amazon Prime. And so since he wants Amazon to offer a lot of different types of media, music, movies, whatever, he's been able to add a high-quality news organization to what he offers to Amazon customers. And then the final piece of this is that the Post technology is absolutely first rate. Reading the Post on a computer, on a phone, on a tablet is really just a pleasure because of the way that they've implemented their digital platforms. They've also done some very interesting things with technology in-house. They've developed their own content management system that they license to other news organizations. Interestingly, the chief technology officer, Shailesh Prakash, was in place when the Graham family sold the Post to Jeff Bezos, and he was already working on a lot of these projects. But the way Prakash described it to me is that Bezos came in and just really gave it a jump start. He put the technology on overdrive, but he did it with a chief technology officer he had inherited, whereas you would think that somebody like Bezos would come in and reinvent the technology from the bottom up. That's really not what he did.
The Washington Post, under Jeff Bezos, is a privately owned company, so the Post doesn't report revenues, profits, or losses. But what we do know is that the Amazon founder is rebuilding the Post, meaning a slow and steady staffing up. He bought the paper with 560 journalists and boosted that to 700. We're talking about the future of the newspaper business, what a new breed of owner can do here. This is The Morning Show. The book is Return of the Moguls, How Jeff Bezos and John Henry Are Remaking Newspapers for the 21st Century. Author Dan Kennedy stays with us, getting your thoughts on the future of newspapers at 800-642-1234. What do you make about rich people buying up newspapers? Have you seen your own newspaper change over time? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment right here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the huge disruption of the newspaper industry, the steep decline in staffing levels of journalists over the past decade, and whether wealthy, civic-minded owners can put newspapers on a sustainable path in the future. This conversation is on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The new book is The Return of the Moguls, How Jeff Bezos and John Henry Are Remaking Newspapers for the 21st Century. Northeastern University journalism professor Dan Kennedy stays with us. And your thoughts, questions about the newspaper industry at 800-642-1234. Does it matter to you who owns your newspaper? What do you do when you hit a paywall? Do you subscribe or go elsewhere for news? And in an era of digital news and fragmented readership, what do you think can be done to save newspapers? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Gary now, waiting in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hello. There's another aspect to the business here. I recently sold my stepladder on Craigslist, for which I paid directly $0. 40 years ago, I would have had to pay to take out a classified ad in a newspaper, which helped fund the paper as a whole. Are the new moguls going to be willing to run these papers at a loss as a public service, or are they going to become sort of organs for the personal views of the very rich owner, or a combination thereof, or so forth?
Gary, good question. Dan Kennedy, what do you make of that?
Well, yes, the Craigslist situation has been huge for the newspaper business, and there's no going back. You really can't compete with free. This is why I say that the current generation of newspaper owners are so determined to get people to pay for their get people to pay for the news. There may be some owners out there who are willing to run their newspapers at a loss, but Jeff Bezos and John Henry are not. They have been working to create sustainable businesses. Just before the break, Kate, you mentioned that the Washington Post has not reported its numbers. That's true, but they have claimed to be profitable each of the last 2 years. Without looking at the numbers, it's hard to know exactly what that means. But certainly, Bezos has enjoyed some business success with the Post. He's not running it as just an ego operation.
Thanks, Gary. Let's go to Phil now in Madison. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. I'd like to put my two cents worth in that I do not read or watch anything that is not a regular news source. And I think people need to cheer on everybody that's resurrecting or bringing back newspapers or whatever, because that's the only thing I feel that has news worthy of reading. And you get away from all the so-called fake news, they call it, the stuff that's on the internet, and or you know where I'm going with this.
Well, and it's
I
Phil.
Hope all newspapers come back.
Yeah, Phil, stronger. It's interesting. You say you look to regular news sources, but what is regular today? Because there are so many voices out there, so many outlets.
The outlets that I trust are the newspaper. I'll read a newspaper and believe that was good reporting, other than see anything that's crazy on the internet that, you know, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, Phil, thanks so much. And Dan Kennedy, that arrives at the question of what is a true newspaper? What is a newspaper?
Right. And, you know, that's really a great question. I have to say my previous book, The Wired City, looked at some very good online-only local news sources and how they were trying to revive local journalism. So I don't think that it only has to come from a newspaper. But to me, what is special about a newspaper is that, at least a daily newspaper, it brings together international, national, local news, and it reaches something of a mass audience. So it's able to have influence, which I think is important. There have been estimates that something like 80% of the accountability journalism that we need to hold government and other large institutions to account comes from newspapers. And I don't think that it matters a bit whether newspapers are in print or online, but I do think it matters that they aggregate all these different types of news into one place and reach something of a mass audience. I think that's the key.
Let's go to Mark now in Sheboygan. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. My story is I live in Sheboygan. There's a local, I guess you could say, billionaire that wants to build a golf course that abuts our local state park. And there's a lot of controversy over that, taking state park land, building onto the beach, tearing down a forest, that kind of thing. Anyway, there's a very, very sparse news about it in our local paper, which is a Gannett paper, Sheboygan Press. When I called them a couple months ago, asked them why there's not more reporting on it, they said, well, we only have two reporters left in the building, and both of them have a close relative, read it as you will, that work for a Kohler entity, which is basically the company wants to build this golf course. So we get no local reporting unless somebody comes down from the Manitowoc sister paper or the Green Bay Press Gazette, which is all owned by Gannett now, and there's very, very little local reporting. And that affects the local populace's ability to, unless you're really involved in this and you're getting everything off the internet, as far as the local paper is concerned, it's not covered at all, and I see that as an issue. But I guess that's, you know, just part of the
Mark, thank you.
Following out of the local reporting.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for bringing your story in Sheboygan up and bringing up Gannett to the conversation. Dan?
Well, you know, first of all, I have to say that's a pretty difficult story, and I am as taken with the fact that both reporters have conflicts of interest, as I am with the fact that there's only two of them. You know, one of the things that wealthy private owners can counteract in the newspaper business is the effect of these large corporate chains that are focused entirely on producing profits for their shareholders, as much as those profits may be diminished from years past. Gannett, actually, by today's standards, would be considered one of the better chains, but chains owned by hedge funds, such as the Digital First Media chain, the Gatehouse Media chain, are cutting newspapers to ribbons and leaving them with staffs that are so small that they really can't do the job that they were intended to do. A quick example, Digital First, which owns the Denver Post, has cut the size of its newsroom to something like 60 full-time people. The Boston Globe, which I think is similar in size and in the size of the area that it serves, still has about 230, 240 full-time journalists. So the Denver Post is smaller than the Globe by a factor of three or four, and that really has nothing to do with anything other than the rapaciousness of Digital First.
So, Dan Kennedy, where does John Henry enter this conversation then about what he's doing with the Boston Globe? What have you been able to focus on in John Henry's approach?
Well, John Henry has a more difficult task than Jeff Bezos because, as I mentioned earlier, there's nothing more difficult these days than trying to make money from running a large regional newspaper. Henry's approach in many ways has been to throw a lot of stuff against the wall and see what sticks. So he has started free websites that cover things such as the Catholic Church. He had to give up on that one because it wasn't really making any money. By life sciences and medicine, that's done better. He's expanded some of the print sections to attract more advertising. Some of them he's had to give up on. But what he really has arrived at is being extremely aggressive in charging for the news, because with advertising not working anymore, charging for the news is pretty much the only strategy that's left. So they charge an awful lot for the print edition. And unfortunately, that has gone a little haywire because they have a new printing plant that just hasn't worked very well. And that's been a huge setback for the Globe's business plans. And they've also charged a lot for digital. And this has been more successful. Despite charging $30 a month for digital, which is more than anybody else, they have managed to attract nearly 100,000 paid subscribers. And what they've said is that if they can get to 200,000 paid subscribers, the Globe starts to look like a financially sustainable business. So that is kind of the main strategy that they're pursuing these days, paid digital. And even though their digital products are not as nice as the Washington Post or the New York Times, nevertheless, it's an attractive digital platform. They do some pretty interesting things with it. And as a result, at least on the digital side, they're growing pretty quickly. And you could see a situation where maybe in a couple of years, they become a break-even or maybe even slightly profitable operation again.
How have these companies approached paywalls and had varying successes with paywalls?
Well, that's what the digital strategy is all about. They erected paywalls that are more or less leaky depending on the strategy of the moment. The Globe right now has an extremely tight paywall. I believe that you can get three free stories every 45 days. which really isn't very much. Frankly, I'm not a marketer, but it would seem to me that the more traditional half a dozen stories a month gives people more of a chance to sample what you're doing and perhaps be enticed into signing up for a digital subscription. But this is what they're trying at the moment. They've been very resolute about getting people to pay for their journalism.
I can't remember in your book if you mentioned it was the Times or the Post who didn't count it against your paywall, didn't count it against your number of stories you access if you shared it on social media.
That's right. Well, you know, that has also been a strategy that's come and gone. And quite frankly, I have forgotten which paper it was, too. It might have been both of them. But I think that the trend since I finished the book, finished writing the book, has been more toward not giving you a free pass on social media. We've had a tightening up of paywalls as newspapers have become more dedicated to the proposition that readers just have to pay. And you look at Facebook in particular, you look at all the problems we're having with Facebook. I think that when I was working on the book, newspapers were really trying to figure out how they could best take advantage of Facebook. And I think it's probably safe to say that today they're thinking about how can we move away from Facebook to some extent.
Fascinating story that you reveal in your book is how the Washington Post was a very got very close to being on the ground floor of the Facebook, but that also went away. What happened there?
Well, Don Graham, one of the leaders of the legendary Graham family, had taken a big interest in Facebook early on, and I mean very early on. And he said it reminded him of something that they did when he was at Harvard in print. You'd get all the information of all your classmates, and he said, you know, this could really be a big thing. And he, when Facebook was going to go public, he had already developed something of a relationship with Mark Zuckerberg, and he wanted to be a major investor in Facebook. And at the last minute, another investor came onto the scene willing to put more money into Facebook for a smaller share of the company. And that actually gave Facebook a much larger stock market capitalization than it would have had if the Washington Post investment had gone through. And Don Graham had a handshake deal with Zuckerberg. And being everybody who knows Don Graham has said that he is very much a gentleman, he let Zuckerberg walk away from the deal and make another deal. And as a result, the Grahams' opportunity to essentially be their own multi-billionaire owners of the Post fell through. And that led to a series of events that finally led to the Post being sold to Jeff Bezos about a dozen years later.
We're talking with Northeastern University journalism professor Dan Kennedy. His new book is The Return of the Moguls, How Jeff Bezos and John Henry Are Remaking Newspapers for the 21st Century. Getting your questions, your thoughts, insights, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Eugene now, who's with us in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Outside of the two papers in the area, the Viola News and or the Epitaph News here in Viola and the county line up in Ontario, both of those are owned independently, but everything around us is chain owned. And I'm wondering what's behind these outfits like Lee and Gannett buying up these small weeklies in these small towns of 800 or 1,000 and running those newspapers? And if this is the trend nationwide, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Eugene, thanks so much for calling. Dan Kennedy, what's behind these chains?
It's been a trend for a long time. I think if you go back to the 1970s, a lot of the original ruling families of newspapers were getting to be too big and unwieldy as they entered their second, third, and fourth generations. And so a number of these chains started to develop and buy up newspapers. And newspapers were a very profitable business at one time. It was almost a license to print money. And Gannett, at one time, operated its papers with profit margins of 30, 40, 50%. Try owning a supermarket chain and getting those kinds of profit margins. You can't do it. Unfortunately, what happened is one of the reasons that newspapers kind of lost favor with the public, maybe not the principal reason, but nevertheless an important factor, is that chain ownership resulted in the news product being cut so much in order to goose up these profits even more that the papers just weren't doing the good job that they used to do. Now, what's going on today is a little bit difficult to fathom because newspapers are not profitable unless they're cut to the absolute bone. And you look at a company, I mentioned Digital First earlier. Digital First is getting a lot of attention these days because it cuts so deeply. And the strategy almost seems to be to cut them and squeeze out what last remaining profits that you can and maybe give up and walk away from them in a few years once you've bled them dry. It's pretty awful for the information needs that we have in a democracy, but it may be a way of squeezing out a few last dollars for their wealthy owners.
Sarah on Facebook says, we dropped our subscription to the local newspaper because since it was bought out by USA Today, the coverage of local news is terrible, Sarah says, if it is covered at all. Carl in New Berlin emailed, said, Craigslist, etc., isn't really free because most people are spending far more per month to be connected to the internet than they ever spent on newspapers. Carl says, also, we need to go back to one newspaper, TV, radio outlet per owner. Get rid of all the rich conglomerate news owners. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Author Dan Kennedy's new book is The Return of the Moguls. Some numbers here. The New York Times reported a paid weekday circulation of a little more than 2.1 million in 2015. The Post keeps its numbers close to its chest, but the Post publisher did say last fall that its paid digital-only subscriptions had crossed the 1 million mark. Rapid growth there. Gathering your thoughts, your questions on the newspaper industry at 800-642-1234. Have you seen your local newspaper change over time? Does your local paper still exist? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment right here on the Ideas Network. A billionaire changed the fortunes for a newspaper in an industry that has been in a tailspin, shedding journalists for the better part of a decade. Can you throw a lot of money at the problem and find a fix? These are questions we're exploring this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Northeastern University journalism professor Dan Kennedy's new book is The Return of the Moguls. Can civic-mindedness and journalistic integrity prevail over balance sheets and profit and loss? Can you find a happy medium? 800-642-1234. Closer to home here in Wisconsin, have you seen your newspaper change? Let's go back to the phones now with Angela joining us from Fish Creek. Hi, Angela.
Good morning. I work for a local newspaper up in Door County. We are a free publication. We do saturation mailings to all of our northern Door County, as well as free subscriptions to our southern area, as well as into Kewaunee County, which is just south of us. And we kind of have a different business model. We want it to be free. We rely on our advertisers, but we can do that because we're effective, because we put out local news. We do some national news as well, but we cover stories people want to hear, and basically our motto is we're telling people stories. And so I think that if the shift becomes telling the stories versus making a profit, newspapers begin to be successful. That's why we're seeing in Wisconsin there are more small newspapers coming up and being successful, as well as we just introduced a bill into legislation that passed in our House to make it so that the requirements for paid subscribers no longer be effective, so that we can be the paper of record. Right now, we're not allowed to be the legal paper of record because we don't have paid subscribers, but we have more papers that go out to our local community than the Gannett publication that is the paid subscription in our area.
Well, great great story to bring to the table there, Angela. Lots to pick apart there. Dan Kennedy, go ahead.
Well, I think the audio was cutting out a little bit on me, but I think that she works at a free print newspaper.
Free publication, yeah. Angela, is it primarily print or online?
We do print. We also have online, and we actually just hit 1 million followers for this past year, since we launched a new website a couple years ago, and this year we surpassed 1 million visitors.
Okay, well, that's great. You know, I think that free news at the extremely local level can work. A lot of times what you see is a nonprofit model where there's some foundation money coming in and grant money, but this sounds like a for-profit operation. You know, I mentioned earlier that there was no worse a place to be in the business than publishing a large regional newspaper. The flip side of that is at the very local level, if you have papers and community news sites that haven't been gobbled up by chains and aren't overburdened by debt that the chains have laid on them, sometimes you can do quite well. I think it's simplistic to say, if we cover local news, we're going to make money, if only it were that simple. But there are a number of examples of papers, such as the one Angela's talking about, that are doing pretty well.
Angela, thanks. Let's go to Marcus now in Madison. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning, Ms. Archer, Mr. Kennedy. Well, Angela is a perfect example of the point I want to make. It seems to me that the biggest myth in journalism is that there is such a thing as journalism, such a discipline. At no point 50 minutes into this discussion has the so-called integrity of journalism or the quality of journalism been a factor in any of this. It's simply a cynical business model. Now, there are all kinds of newspapers on us that are small operations that can print the factual news as well as anybody else. I'd like to ask the question, why should anyone care whether one newspaper mogul billionaire makes another pile or not? It has nothing to do with people's lives. People could do this research themselves, or let people with integrity like Angela do.
Marcus, thanks. Dan Kennedy, go ahead with your thoughts.
I didn't really detect a question in there.
Well, and so I think what Marcus is also getting at here, I mean, the Washington Post has its motto, democracy dies in darkness.
Yeah.
And that if you put in the quality journalism, that at the end of the day will make the difference, that will make newspapers prevail. But you're also seeing, as you point out, there are a whole lot of other things going on in that universe, in that space, in order to make a newspaper stay above board and be able to make it these days.
No, that's right. And you know, the caller was suggesting that nobody cares if these moguls make another big pile of money. I think that especially here in Boston, as we look at what John Henry's trying to do with the Boston Globe, he just doesn't want to keep losing large piles of money. And I think it is vitally important for democracy if people can figure out how to run these important institutions without losing money, because then they will continue. If they are going to continue losing money, then they're going to start to go out of business, and I don't think that that's good for society. I understand the caller's point that everybody could go out and do their own research. I suppose everybody could grow their own food as well, but we tend to live in a society where we have a division of labor, and I think that people are too busy making a living and taking care of their families to do their own journalism, which is why they outsource it to people who are paid to do that.
Let's go to Russ now in Dowston. Hi, Russ.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
So my question is whether or not your guest feels that a cable TV model could possibly work here. I know people are cutting the cords and it's a little outdated, but I have a news feed through my smartphone, and I love it because I have a lot of different interests in astronomy, local politics, national-level politics, and it lets me pull from a bunch of different sources. So, I mean, I'd be happy to pay for my news because I use it every day, but I don't want to have, like, four or five different subscriptions. I'd rather just pay one price, and then whatever I use, maybe that's how they decide how to divvy up my my fee every month, you know, based on use. You'd have to do something to avoid just, like, clickbait getting everything. Maybe it's the quality of the journalism that's a factor as well. But what does your caller think about a cable TV model?
I think that packages of services makes a whole lot of sense. And I think that everybody in the news business, even as we move into digital subscriptions, we're a little bit wary because we know that people might pay for one, two, maybe even three digital subscriptions. But that's not really the way we consume news anymore. We're all over the place. We're all over the Internet. And if all of the doors are suddenly going to start closing, except for the one or two that we're paying for, that's really not going to work. So I think that may actually be the next phase of paying for news, some sort of a package deal. You know, the Washington Post actually has gotten in on this a little bit. There are many dozens of local papers around the country where if you are a paid subscriber to these papers, you get a free digital subscription to the Washington Post thrown in. And that may be the beginnings of the idea that the caller's talking about.
Russ, thanks so much. Let's go to Tom in Burlington. You're up. Hi, Tom.
We were talking about in print and online, and in the checkout counter, there's a tremendous amount of, during the election, the Inquirer had these pictures of Mrs. Clinton, and she always looked a bad hair day. And I was wondering, the model that the Inquirer uses, and the money that now that the money that the Facebook is making from selling information. They used to sell advertising, but now they're buying information. Could you maybe talk about that?
Okay, so Tom, wondering how outlets like the National Enquirer make money, and how does this also factor into what has happened with our data, and specifically Facebook?
Okay, well, I don't know that the Enquirer makes its money in a way that's any different from any other publication. They charge for it, and they run advertising. I don't think that any legitimate news outlet wants to follow their editorial model, to put it mildly. You know, the whole Facebook thing has become a real conundrum. And on top of that, when you look at what Facebook is under fire for, which is essentially gathering data on its users and seeking to monetize that data, unfortunately, that's exactly what everybody does on the Internet, including newspapers. So when you see ads on a newspaper website, they're doing the same thing. They're gathering your data and trying to show you the most relevant ads. And this is something that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. So I think that what happens to our data may prove to be the next big debate in what's going on in the digital space, whether you're talking about newspapers, Facebook, or anything else. Not to sound like I know only one song, but that may bring us back to the idea that what really matters is getting people to pay for journalism and playing down the role that advertising has traditionally had, because it's not like those advertisements that are in print. Today, when you look at advertisements online, you're looking at the ads, but they're looking back at you, too.
Mm. But outside of an ownership change or a windfall owner, if you will, are there takeaways from the Washington Post or Boston Globe that these papers can look to in order to try to turn a profit? Papers that haven't had a big ownership change. I know that in your book you said the LA Times was a bit jealous when Bezos went after the Post and not the LA Times.
Yes, of course, the LA Times, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name, but the LA Times just got its own billionaire owner, and so there is some optimism out there that the LA Times' fortunes could be revived. There are bad billionaire owners, too. I mean, a few years ago, Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul, bought the Las Vegas Review-Journal, apparently for the purpose of tormenting some of his enemies in the casino business. So that is the flip side of that. I think that probably what's going on in Boston is very, very important to watch, because if the Boston Globe can get back to profitability simply by getting people to pay for journalism online and doing it in a fairly straightforward way and charging, frankly, quite a bit of money, I think that you'll see that that's something that's emulated by just about every paper in the country.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate. I've appreciated being on.
Dan Kennedy is an associate professor of journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. His new book is The Return of the Moguls, How Jeff Bezos and John Henry Are Remaking Newspapers for the 21st Century. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Nyasia Ellison. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.